If you're hearing this, it means tickets are now on sale for our streaming Cybactacular.
That's what we're calling the streaming show of our Star Trek V review that we toured last year. We filmed our Hollywood show, and it's going to be streaming on Thursday, May 16th at 7 p.m. Eastern Time. And the stream will be available for a couple of weeks after that. If you can't watch right at the premiere time. A couple of pieces of information about this. If you support us at MaximumFun.org/join and your membership is current, check your email inbox because Maximum Fun will have emailed you a promo code to get $5 off your ticket. And also, we have some VIP packages available that include a meet and greet with me and Adam. Those are going fast, so jump on that if you want a meet and greet VIP package. Again, it's greatestgentour.com to get your tickets for the streaming Cybactacular.
Captain!
Not here.
Captain!
Report.
Signatures detected.
Shields up.
Signatures detected.
Red alert.
Context Starfleet Command.
What's happening?
Context Starfleet Command.
Delay that order.
Context Starfleet Command.
This is the captain.
Context Starfleet Command.
Get out of my chair. Chair.
We have engaged the Klingons.
Klingons.
Welcome to The Greatest Discovery. It's a new Star Trek podcast from the makers of The Greatest Generation. I'm Adam Pranica.
I'm Ben Harrison.
I'm surrounded by like open, half-empty suitcases because it's useless. Like, you don't want to unpack mid-tour.
Yeah.
You're better off just leaving things packed, swapping stuff out.
This must boil your fucking blood, man.
it's not good for my mentals.
Not a thing that Adam is a fan of. You are a unpack when you get home, like minute you get home, no matter how late you get home, you unpack. Because
all the way.
You'd be tossing and turning, thinking about having an undone thing.
Yeah.
Nothing you hate more than an undone thing.
Yeah. I know. And now I'm looking at a bunch of undone things around my room. It's great.
Yeah. Wow.
How has tour been going for you so far?
I guess better than you. I'm not... Why did you ask that way?
I'm doing great. It's because I've got an idea. I thought maybe we could start sharing some tour stories.
Oh, yeah.
On the show.
So as of this recording, we've done 3 live shows. I think Toronto will have just happened when this one comes out, right?
Right. This is a tour story about something that happened in Minneapolis.
Okay.
And I got some audio for a drop here.
Wow.
It's not fully produced, so it's going to need to be produced.
Okay. You didn't load it onto your Rodecaster so that you could live trigger it while we're sitting here?
That would be a Ben thing to do. Ben has all the quality in-show material. I've got to have it done after the fact. This is a tour story.
Tour story!
Of two podcasters.
Welcome to the Greatest Generation.
Who chose to leave their house, go on the road, and do their show in front of an audience. To find out what happens when things stop being edited and start getting real. The tour world. Ben, you were there when this happened to me. There's like stories of embarrassment, and then there's stories of embarrassment that happen when you're not wearing very much clothes. And this was that kind of combination for me.
Yeah.
We were enjoying the hot tub area of the hotel we were staying in Minneapolis.
Right. This is a rooftop hot tub at a hotel in a city that is so cold that like the downtown is designed to let people walk all around it without ever having to go outside.
In the tunnel system. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it lived up to its reputation temperature-wise. It was very cold the entire time we were there. And so cold at night that people were like putting their towels next to the jacuzzi and they were freezing hard.
Yeah.
Like they could not be used.
Yeah. Somebody picked up their towel like and it had been in a lump that had.
It looked like one of your high school gym socks when they picked it up.
Yeah, exactly. They had to break it apart to get it to be flexible again.
And we're having a great time. I was having a great time. This is like one of those jumbo size hot tubs that you can fit a dozen people in. It was fun.
You were having a great time because the server came around and when you ordered a drink, he actually brought you one.
This was a problem that I was seeking to correct. I had a drink and you did not, and I wanted to fix this problem. So I got up out of the hot tub, put on my robe, and did that walk over broken glass when the pool deck is so cold and you're in bare feet. Like, I walked to the door that led to the bar where I thought I could find the bartender, and I opened it up and I turned the corner. And I just wasn't thinking about it, Ben, because when I turned the corner, I locked eyes with the people sitting at the corner of the bar,
yeah,
who were dressed really nicely. It's like a Friday night in Minneapolis. They're enjoying some highballs or whatever. And I lock eyes with them wearing a very shabbily tied robe over my still wet body.
Because you didn't want to use the towel because then the towel is kicked, right?
Yeah. Yeah, we only had the one towel. I only had the one towel. It's not like we were sharing a towel. I had the one towel, and there was like that area where there's a host should be there.
Yeah.
How long would you wait wet where the host is supposed to be at a bar before you give up? I feel like I gave it a good 30 seconds of just really hoping that someone would help me, and no one did, Ben.
Wow.
So then what I did is I turned around and grabbed the door handle of the door behind me and gave it a good pull, and it was locked. And then I realized the second error, which was I did not have my room key on me, the room key necessary to enter the pool deck area. That was over by the Shea Long, where my towel was. And so I had to trundle down a hall to a different door, like leading to the pool locker room.
Right.
Which also required a key.
Yeah.
So now I'm standing in front of that door for like a good minute. There is no one around there because it's so far away from the bar. And I'm like, I can't get in the elevator and go to my room. I don't have my room key. I'm super fucked. I'm imagining I'm gonna have to go all the way down to the lobby, which is the only place in the entire building worse than next to the bar if you are wet in an open robe.
Meanwhile, I'm sitting in the hot tub, and I had really been heavily relying on you socially because there were other people in the hot tub and we'd been having pleasant conversations with them. But the second a trusted friend is gone, I clam right up. So I'm just I don't know what to do. I don't know these people. I don't know if I can trust anyone.
I did not mean to leave you behind that way. That wasn't my intent. So I'm waiting outside the, it's like an airlock basically, a door that leads to a locker room that leads out to the pool deck, and no one is around. No one's around for me to even ask to let me in using their room key.
Man.
Finally, lady walks around the corner, and I'm like, you're not going to believe this by looking at me, but I actually belong out there, and I left my key. If you could swipe me in, I'd really appreciate it. And she did.
She believed you.
And I trundled back out there, and I got into that hot tub again, which was, it felt so good after being so cold and embarrassed at the same time to just submerge myself in those hot bubs.
Yeah.
And feel better again. But the drinkman did not end up coming for like another 10 or 15 minutes. It was a sad state of affairs. But like, honestly, if I'm a server and I have the choice between serving the warm customers inside and potentially slipping and falling on the ice outside.
Yeah.
I know where I'm staying.
Yeah. Yeah. You can't really hold it against them.
No. No. And we didn't. We finally got you a nice glass of mezcal. And after those guys were downed, we were on with the rest of our night. But let this be a lesson to everyone out there. Always keep your hotel key on your person. It should be obvious, but this is the thing. Like, we've been so out of practice in hoteling.
Yeah.
And being out on tour.
We haven't gotten our hotel legs back yet.
Yeah. Maybe by the time we reach Toronto, that will be the case. But,
There's a well-known rule of Greatest Gen that there's no bits on tips, Adam.
Correct.
I did a bit in this hotel that I wanted to run by you and see if you can sign off on it or not.
Oh, wow. We're really getting double the money for this Marin. For this brand new segment on the show. I love it. Lay it on me.
So I think we were going to dinner the night before our Minneapolis show, and
I like walked out of my room, and as the door was closing, I was like, oh, do I have my key on me? And I slapped my back pocket and I was like, I've got my wallet and my key is in my wallet. I'm good. And I hear the door click and I was like, maybe I should just double check that it's in my wallet. And I look and I'm like, sure enough, not in the wallet. So I go down and, you know, we're like on our way out the door, but I just stopped by the front desk because I didn't want to deal with it when I got back. And I, the bit I did was, hi, this is your regularly scheduled guy who left his key card in his room on his way out the door. All I do is bits. No matter what. I got a little chuckle from the clerk at the front desk as he made me a new copy.
That's fun. If you're asking what my ruling is, that is way in play.
Okay, because it's not a tipping situation.
No, it's not. But it's also not making fun of the person in any way or making their life more difficult.
No, I'm the butt of the joke. I mean, totally. I'm only making his life more difficult insofar as I was an idiot and didn't make sure I had my ticket before my door locked behind me.
How much of a front desk person's job is it to just replace keys?
It's got to be 20%, and it goes up to 30% when I'm in the hotel.
I'm not trying to take anyone's gerb.
They took your job!
They took your job!
I'm not trying to replace anyone's gerb with a robot.
That sounds like a job for me!
But it stands to reason that that one specific task could be a robot of some kind, right?
There was a feeling that I had like 5 years ago when phones started to have NFC stuff in them that I was like, oh, this is just going to be on your phone and you'll never have to ask about it. You won't even have to stop at the front desk on the way in.
Yeah.
And I'm really surprised that that hasn't happened yet.
More and more hotel chains are doing that. Hey, do you want to just check in on the phone and use your phone as the key and stuff? And I've never done it. I'm expecting it not to work for whatever reason.
Yeah.
And I always like the interaction on check-in. Like, I just don't want to go to the room. I want to talk to a person and see if they've got a capacity for an upgraded room.
You want to slide that $20 across the counter at them and see what they think.
Every time. And as the official $20 slider of our business, since you crashed and burned in Vegas, I'm the one that handles that bit of business for us both.
You have such a higher batting average and so much more confidence in doing it.
I did pretty good on our last leg. I think I got 2 out of 3.
Yeah. The petty cash folder really served us well.
Yeah.
But Adam, do you want to see if this episode served us well? Should we get into reviewing season 2, episode 5 of Star Trek: Picard?
Sure do, Ben. It's called Fly Me to the Moon. Our first Frakes episode of the season, yeah?
True. It is. This one starts with a really intensely strange intercutting where we're cutting back and forth from this astronaut in an emergency situation. You know, she's getting warnings. She's talking to Houston about how there's space debris headed for the ship. And this is an astronaut in, you know, our kind of time period, not a future astronaut.
Right.
Intercutting that with Picard, like, talking to human Laris in her apartment and just kind of shooting the breeze, getting to know her.
Things are going better in this reality. I think we're really hitting it off.
She invited me up to see her etchings.
Etchings don't mean etchings. Etchings mean sex.
She is not called Laris. She's called Talum, and she is armed. She has like a gun that really reminded me of the old guy in Star Trek Generations gun.
Oh,
in that
yeah.
It like has that hinging action.
Another Elorian.
Maybe.
Well, I mean, that's an ongoing question without an answer throughout this episode for sure. Is like, what exactly is Talum?
Right. Why does she look exactly like Laris? Like, Picard even is like, maybe you're her ancestor, but that doesn't make any sense.
Why is he so incurious about this? This would be the only thing on my mind. I could not get past this if I were Picard.
I don't mean to make you uncomfortable, but you look exactly like this woman that I really wish I'd smashed before I left my own time period.
if you're gonna have a sidearm that aims using kind of a three-axis camera gimbal situation, kind of looks like a good one to have, right? Because that's what this weapon looked like to me. Like,
yeah,
one of those little DJI camera gimbal things.
An Osmo gun.
Yeah. Yeah, it looked like an Osmo gun for sure.
Yeah. The inner cutting is so strange because the tone of the astronaut in emergency situation is so peaked. And mm-hmm. the conversation between Picard and Talum is so, I mean, it's like, it's slightly tense. Like it, she does pull out a gun on him, but then they're like sitting in her lounge area, like
yeah.
talking over why he's here and what he's up to.
I like Picard doing all the same character reveals that he did with young Guinan earlier, and none of them are hitting.
He's like, usually this material kind of works a little bit better.
It's all right. I mean, sometimes you just have a bad show and you can't explain it.
Yeah. Hard to say why that was, Toronto. So this it turns out this astronaut, we've seen her before. She was in the button of the last episode reading the Dixon Hill novel. Appreciation for Dixon Hill runs in the family, as does faring in space.
I mean, it's kind of hard to recognize her in a helmet in an emergency situation.
Yeah,
I don't think I'm an idiot for not totally putting the two together until later.
No, you probably wouldn't recognize me if I was in this helmet.
It's true.
I can't breathe in this thing!
So yeah, it was a simulation, and this is a sim that's being run right ahead of launch, so she's really up in her head. She failed her own personal Kobayashi Maru right before going to actual space.
You've probably read all the books and seen all of the documentaries about like the Apollo missions and stuff, and how the astronauts were tested, not just in the tech, but in the psych profiles. Like, they were groomed to be almost robotic in that way. So when you see Rene Picard break here emotionally, it was super concerning for me. I'm like, if launch is 3 days away, that's not a lot of time to remove all emotional outbursts from your system.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, I think that there's a lot about the way the Apollo missions were run that I think NASA looks back on and goes, that was wrong.
I'm not advocating for bringing back the greatness of how we select astronauts from the Apollo era. But, I mean, there are reasons for filtration via psychoanalysis
mm-hmm.
make some sense in the way that you don't want someone becoming hyper-emotional in a emergency situation.
Yeah, you want somebody that's chill under pressure.
And, yeah.
It seems like the pressure is definitely getting to her. But that's kind of our dun-dun-dun, the reveal that this is Rene Picard, the astronaut that is going on a mission in a couple of days, nicely fitting in with the established timeline of about when the divergence took place. And she's also the person that Talum watches after.
Interesting.
After the theme, we're back at the La Serena, where the Borgs Queen is talking in her sleep. Are we calling her Nana Borgs? Is that just the christening here? Nana Borgs is the sort of old that falls asleep sitting up, and she's talking to herself here.
Yeah, with a hand on the keyboard, she's typing just like an endless string of R's into an email to her grandson.
I love the idea that a way for her to soothe herself is to listen to a bunch of phone call voices at the same time.
Yeah.
That is a really nifty bit of character building there that I liked a lot.
Yeah. There's some shots of screens in the La Serena where there's sort of like Borg colored graphics like mushing around in the computer. So it seems like she's not totally cut off from the computer, but she does need to get access to it. And so she tries a bunch of voices and hits on Rios's voice pattern working to unlock systems on the La Serena and enable her to place a cellular phone call.
She does that magic trick where she changes her voice. Data did this when he was taken over the ship. So this is a fun callback to all those times, right?
Yeah. And she calls La Police.
It turns out Picard's voice is super easy to do an impression of.
What is going on? I mean, it makes sense that Rios would be the only one who's got voice command here, right? Because this is dark future ship. Timeline La Serena.
I mean, shouldn't President Seven also have voice authorization over any ship in the Confederation fleet?
Man, good question.
Yeah. I've got a random question about just a really brief moment in Star Trek Picard Season 2, Episode 5. Now, we know that Nana Borgs, I'll tell you about why we call her that a little later on. Like, she can do great impressions in order to break into the voice-activated security system of the La Serena, but, like, if she had done an impression of Seven, does presidential voice authorization gain her access to the ship? I'll just go ahead and take my answer over on the merch table.
Oh, one other thing. She's calling the French police, and the first person she talks to, she speaks English, but then when she gets connected to the police, she speaks French, but in an American accent. So why did she assume that the telephone operator could speak English?
Oh, and one last thing, because I'd never, like, God, it's so weird to, like, talk into a microphone. I don't usually have this kind of audience. I thought it was funny, like, you know how sort of, like, in America, you say all cops are bastards? In France, do you say all French cops are baguettes?
That bit, is that bit hitting, or do people...
If you want to laugh at that, you can go laugh at me outside in the hall. Tell me how that works for you.
I'm going to get up on the Roddenberry stage and try some more material in between official things. So, check me out.
Get a life.
Probably not a great time to be doing questionable comedic material in a time where comics are getting punched in the face.
Meanwhile, Seven and Raffi are out in the sticks tracking the bus that Rios is on. He's being moved to a sanctuary zone by Homeland Security, along with a bunch of other undocumented people. And there is a real debate over how hard we should stomp this butterfly between Raffi and Seven.
Time travel rules? What the hell is wrong with you?
Right, and the tension is that Raffi is willing to stomp them all.
Stupid bug! You go squish now!
And Seven is extremely reluctant to do that.
As long as I stand perfectly still and don't touch anything, I won't destroy the future.
But they come up with a compromise which has to do with the tricorder they've got. They can do a little, like, mini EMP out of the tricorder, and that brings the bus to a stop right in front of them.
Perfect. I don't know why there was any debate in the first place. If you can do this, this is all you need to do.
That should be the argument after the fact, is Seven going, like, why did you want to, like, make a huge scene? We could have done this the whole time.
So the bus creaks to a stop, and Rios starts telling all the other dudes on it, like, get ready, like, it's about to go down. My friends are busting me out. Make sure you move really fast. And Ice Guy, who just loves what he does for a living, is really pissed off. It seems like he doesn't speak Spanish.
I was just going to say, how fucking dumb do you have to be as an organization, and how idiotic do you have to be as a person within it to not speak the language of your primary target?
So fucking dumb. Just galactically dumb.
Yeah.
Whatever the opposite of galaxy brain is, that's Ice.
Keep doing that. I mean, don't keep doing Ice stuff. The Ice stuff is bad, but keep not learning the language, guys.
Yeah. So he barges in there, and Raffi starts Star Trek fighting him, even though he's got the hands of the thing. And there's, like, a fun, like, origin story on the Kirk chop, because the other guy does a full Kirk chop with his hands cuffed.
Yeah.
Nice guy.
A good hit.
And Seven and Raffi take out the driver. They cut everybody's bonds and let him go.
Raffi mistakes one of the people on the bus for Elnor, which I think is a really easy mistake to make, because this is one of the people on the bus who sliced through an ICE agent, like,
right,
and cleaved him completely in half.
Yeah, he's covered in the guy's blood. And so, you know, his face is a little bit obscured.
Hey, how and why does Pedro have a cell phone at the end here? Did he have that thing keistered? Doesn't seem like you should have one of those on this kind of bus ride. Unless the world's dumbest ICE agent didn't do the pat down and just let that thing go through.
When I was arrested in Queens, one of the guys that I was with got a cell phone into the cell with us and was like making calls and like arranging things.
Did it smell like a butt?
I don't know how he did it, because they made me take like the shoelaces out of my shoes to go in that cell. But somehow that guy snuck a fucking cell phone past them.
It would take me so long to make my call if I were offered a phone in a cell, because I just wouldn't want to touch it.
Yeah.
I would wait until I had a sandwich bag that I could wrap it in before dialing the numbers.
He doesn't even have AirPods, so he has to like hold it right up to his face.
Yeah.
Ew.
Pedro has pink eye now. Sorry, Pedro. I mean, the good news is you made it off the bus. The bad news is that...
you're going to need a course of antibiotics, and it's your own damn fault.
Yeah. Time to go to the free clinic, Pedro.
Talum and Picard continue to have their very long conversation in her apartment, and he kind of realizes that she is a Gary 7 type.
Gary 7. He too was recruited by superior beings as an agent who would, in your words, protect the tapestry of history.
I love when new Trek calls back to old Trek that I've actually seen.
Yeah, agreed. I feel like this moment turns to camera and goes, all right, so we've answered all the questions about Talum. But I don't feel like the Gary 7 question answered a bunch of questions about the Gary 7 people, you know?
No. Yeah, but it's just like there is a thing that we don't know anything about that does this type of thing.
Right.
But I still have questions. Why do they do it?
Yeah, like I understand Gary 7 as an instrument, but I still don't understand the where from or the why.
There's a lot of talk about the tapestry of history and making sure that individual threads stay where they're supposed to be. And Talum describes that as being a big project that she's involved in, but she doesn't have a 30,000 foot view of it. She has a very specific view of it and just trusts that the rest of the project is, you know, working alongside her. And that's very interesting, like that she doesn't have questions herself.
Right. I kind of wish they drilled down further into this a little bit more in a philosophical way. Like, is this what people conflate with fate? Like, if you are a free will versus fate person, is your choice there having to do with whether or not you accept or reject the idea of a Gary 7 type, making sure your thread lies flat throughout the course of your life, you know?
Yeah, I mean, this definitely feels like they're starting to grapple with some of those ideas, destiny and whatnot.
There's like a morality aspect to it that goes totally unregarded, though.
Yeah, it feels like it's a theme that's being set up, and I wonder if we'll get way more into it over the course of the season.
We get to see Renee in a therapy session.
And you monitor it? This is private.
Is it?
She's wearing her Europa Mission polo shirt there.
Yeah. I don't know why I assumed the Europa Mission was a TV show.
I thought that was fun.
It was an actual mission the entire time.
I mean, we aren't totally sure that it isn't at this point, right?
Right.
Like it could be.
Yeah, like it's the deep space mission that is also being broadcast as a reality TV program.
Europa Mission is filmed before a live studio audience. And Rene Picard has some stage fright.
So what Talum describes Rene as being is a person that has crazy high aptitude. She rattles off all these like really impressive early in life accomplishments that this precocious kiddo had, but also that Rene has a anxious and depressive personality, which... Man, I wish I was also crazy super smart like Renee. That would make the anxiety and depression go down a little easier.
I love that that's what made you feel bad in this scene. It's like the idea that like all of our smartest and best and brightest are often saddled with this sort of counterpoint to their personality.
I'm just saddled with the counterpoint. Hey, what gives?
She's a real Doogie Howser type.
Yeah.
And if you were thinking that you would avoid a theme like this in the Picard show, believing that ideas of mental health being risen to the forefront of a television show might just be in Discovery, you're wrong. You're wrong. That is also what this show is about.
I think that this is handled more deftly than it is in Discovery, though. It's not just grief. There's a push and pull in her life that in some way Talum is there to make sure stays in balance. This also is, like, I'm realizing this scene, we're like 13 minutes into the episode. Like, Picard and Talum have been having the same conversation for the entire first 13 minutes of this episode. And, like, we are now intercutting with a second thing that Renee is up to.
Right.
So this is her exit interview with a psychologist who is meant to be signing off on her mental fitness for duty. And Talum has like tapped into it and has the surveillance footage. And Picard hears the voice of the therapist and is like, I've got to see the face because that voice sounds super familiar.
If you could you just play the voice on a speaker in my nook? That's where I'm used to hearing it the most. Ben, what do you make of Q being reading the paper in the last episode and being 8 feet away from her, unrecognized, and now it is revealed that Q is the therapist for Rene Picard? What did the last scene mean in the last episode where they're out on the patio together?
So he already had the Europa mission patch on his jacket. So presumably in inserting himself in this timeline, he has like established a role for himself.
Maybe he's the workplace psychologist and he belonged out on that patio because that was the workplace patio.
Yeah, but she's never met him because she's just going in for this final assessment, I guess.
You know what?
I don't know.
I think we broke it. I think that makes sense. All right.
So Picard gets a look at Q and he says,
that's not a therapist. It's a space station.
In the next scene, Dr. Soong presents to a panel that includes Leah Thompson.
Yeah. Famous director Leah Thompson.
And this is not a presentation that goes well at all.
No.
I don't know what it is, but when I kiss you, it's like I'm kissing my brother.
He needs more visual aids. I think that's the problem. Mm. How do you expect to hold these people's attention?
You start with a joke.
Imagine, if you will, I am a god.
This is like a panel that is reviewing his funding and his fitness to continue working on the genetic research he's been doing. And it has a very eugenics-tinged angle to it in a way that leapt out as very gross right off the bat.
I mean, Brent Spiner is just a fuckboy haircut away from from like being the whole thing. You know?
Yeah. This is also a heavily intercut scene with Soji, or Corey, as she is known in this time period. Everybody's mm-hmm. got a counterpoint in this time period.
Yeah.
And she's the daughter of Adam Soong, and she's a bubble girl. She can't go outside, and she's kind of hearing him out after he comes home very disappointed from his meeting.
The construction of this is sort of like a reverse Ocean's 11, right? So like instead of talking about the heist and then seeing it happen perfectly, you see Dr. Soong eating shit in the presentation, and then the aftermath at home when he's super disappointed.
Totally. One other thing I noticed in this scene is that one of the other panelists is named Vasily Rozhenko.
Oh, yeah. Wow.
So there's a lot of threads going on here.
They really make you read a lot of props on Picard.
Yeah. I wonder if we're going to get some Worf in this season.
Oh, boy.
That would be great.
A Q-Worf!
He's just stuck behind a door.
Yeah, he was trying to get into this episode, but
yeah,
he couldn't do it.
Must be sealed.
Boy, Dr. Soong jabs a massive needle into his daughter's arm and then processes a sample from it. You can tell that Carrie has had a lot of needles before because this does not affect her in that way that a gauge of needle typically would.
Yeah.
Yikes. You get really right up in there on the angle too.
Like the Bucatini of needles.
Yeah, you could suck a boba through through this thing with room to spare.
So while she sleeps, and while we intercut back to this failure at the panel, we also see that Soong is doing some kind of genetic research on his computer involved with the blood sample, and he keeps getting results that are like 99.78% likelihood of failure. So whatever he's trying to do for her is not working. And she speaks a little bit about, like, when I can go outside, when I can leave the bubble, yeah, I would like to go swimming. And it just doesn't seem like his research is bearing any kind of fruit in that regard.
How did he create all of this wealth? Like, if he's such a bad geneticist,
yeah,
who no one wants to have on their board or give funding to, like, there is a backstory here that we haven't gotten at all.
I mean, the only backstory that is hinted at here is that he did something for a private military.
Yeah, he got that sweet, sweet contractor money.
Some Blackwater dough.
Yeah.
So while he is doing his failing research, he gets a sort of The Matrix-style message on his computer screen. And he gets a bunch of papers sent to him, and then the screen says, check your 3D printer, and he turns around, and for some reason, a two-dimensional business card is being printed out on the 3D printer.
Can you even print 2D things on a 3D printer? They shouldn't let you.
Yeah, just error, paper jam.
What the hell?
How expensive are the cartridges on a 3D printer, I wonder?
Oh, man, they really get you over a barrel if you buy a 3D printer.
Yeah.
Did you call the number on the card, by the way?
No. Did you?
Call the number on the card. It's fun.
Oh, shit. I will. Is it too long to drop into the episode?
I think it's more fun if people just call it.
Oh, okay.
Here, I'll tell people the number.
Good idea.
If they missed it in the episode, the number is 323-634-5667.
Can you do that again with, hey Siri, call?
Hi, this is Biz, and this is the final season of One Bad Mother, a comedy podcast about parenting. This is going to be a year of celebrating all that makes this podcast and this community magical.
I'm so glad that I found your podcast.
I just cannot thank you enough for just being the voice of reason as I'm trying to figure all of this out.
Thank you, and cheers to your incredible show and the vision you had to provide this space for all of us.
This is still a show about life after giving life. And yes, there will be swears. You can find us on MaximumFun.org. And as always, you are doing a great job.
All right, class. Tomorrow's exam will cover the science of cosmic rays, the morals of art forgery, and whether or not fish can drown. Any questions? Yes, you in the back. What is this?
It's the podcast Let's Learn Everything,
where we learn about science and a bit of everything else. My name's Tom. I study cognitive and computer science, but I'll also be your teacher for intermediate emojis.
My name's Caroline, and I did my master's in biodiversity conservation, and I'll be teaching you intro to things the British Museum stole.
My name's Ella. I did a PhD in stem cell biology, so obviously I'll be teaching you the history of fan fiction.
Class meets every other Thursday on Maximum Fun.
So do I still get credit for this?
No.
Obviously not.
No.
It's a podcast.
Back at the chateau, the French police have arrived, and it's Leclerc. He's chosen to go in alone.
He slid over the hood of his Citroën police cruiser.
Ben, my question is, you're casting a scared Frenchman, and you don't blow in a call to Manu Sadia? Like, you telling me he wouldn't pick up the phone?
I guarantee
this,
you
this
he would not pick up the phone.
This part was made for him.
Yeah, so he's like creeping around the haunted chateau, and like he is in the same room that Gerardi is in, sleeping on a couch, but does not see her, does not make her.
He is not a good police officer.
Nana Borg is so lucky that he found the ship before he found Gerardi.
Yeah. Out the window, it seems like the La Serena cloak is not doing a great job.
Yeah.
What did you make of that? And this isn't the first time we've seen it on an exterior shot. I wonder if at some point it's just going to fail and then all hell's going to break loose.
Yeah, I wonder if that's just like what a cloak looks like on a planet surface where it like is much harder to do than just stars or
right.
whatever. But yeah. Yeah, I mean, it seems like shining a flashlight should not make a cloak super obvious, but in this case it does. Maybe it's that the ship is super busted and still in self-repair mode.
Yeah. Boy, Nana Borg's setup inside the Compucifix really scares the shit out of him in a way that it should.
Yeah, he gets summoned deeper and deeper into the ship after, again, we don't get a shot of somebody going from the exterior to the interior of the cloaked ship.
I don't know how many Rob Zombie horror films you need to watch for this to not scare you if you're Leclerc. He's clearly not a fan.
Yeah. And when she reveals herself to him, she hentai tentacles him. And it's real, real scary and gross.
Yeah. I thought I knew what this tentacle would look like. We see the tentacle later, and I was shocked.
It's very upsetting.
Yeah.
My hero.
Back in Los Angeles, Dr. Soong gets lunch with Q, who is revealed to have been the person behind the leet hacksawing that we saw earlier.
Soong gets a lot of these kinds of requests, and he filters for crackpot just from jump. He doesn't even sit down when he starts this filtration.
I'm enough of a crackpot myself, sir. I don't need to team up with another crackpot.
Yeah, it's the narcissism of minor crackpot differences.
I get everything from basement-dwelling Nazis to rich heiresses who want me to clone their fucking cats.
Q has a lot of parlor tricks that he can use to get Soong to stay, and a lot of flowery language to hold his interest. It's an intoxicating combination, I think, if you're Soong here.
Yeah. I was thinking about how clever and adept Q seems to still be despite not having finger snappy powers. Like, he can still hack a computer, he can still synthesize a serum, he can still predict within 1 second of accuracy how long it's going to take for somebody to sit down and hear him out. So it seems like he's not completely defanged.
Yeah.
By whatever is causing his lapse in awesomeness of power.
He sure just seemed to be with it more than he was in those earliest scenes with Picard.
Totally.
Oh, well, thank you. I worked hard on that.
So he's basically proposing a trade, and the upside for him has not been revealed yet, but he gives Soong a, it almost looks like a glass bullet with like blue liquid in it. And
sure
he
did.
Says, give this stuff a try. If you're interested, maybe we can work together.
Dr. Soong's like, how exactly do I administer this? And they cut back to Q, and he just kind of looks knowingly. And Soong's like, really? I mean, I've got a bunch of needles. They're big. I mean, they're really big needles. Are you actually suggesting that it would be more comfortable for for Corey to take this rectally? Q, again, just doesn't say anything.
There's no flared base.
How big would a hypodermic needle need to be for you to choose rectal?
I think that the one in this scene,
I think so too,
probably is that.
God, yeah, I think so. I think that's the right choice. I think it's the only choice.
Yeah, I mean, there's nothing wrong with a little item in the old keister, right?
There's nothing wrong with a little glass in the backpack.
See? Right there. Crackpot talk.
Picard and Tulum are still... I'm calling her Tulum in a way that's kind of fun, but yeah, probably isn't how she'd like her name pronounced.
A lot of influencers love to visit her and take selfies in her magnificent swimming holes.
A very funny part in a very popular Twitter thread of not that long ago. But neither of them can understand why Q won't just snap his fingers and change the timeline. Why all the fucking around with people? Why the games?
Is he trying to find out? Or Picard is trying to persuade Talum to team up with him. She's describing this big gala that's about to happen ahead of pre-launch Quar for the Europa mission. Basically saying, like, if we can persuade Renee to get as far as going into Quar, there's probably not a way for her to back out after that. And that would preserve the timeline. That would preserve the thread.
Yeah.
And Picard has basically got her persuaded, okay, like, there is an actual threat to the timeline that I've been sent here to monitor. And he's like, okay, let's go, like, do a bunch of stuff. And she's like, no, not so fast. I kind of work alone. And he's actually able to talk her into joining the team.
Was there ever a tension with you in this scene waiting for that other shoe to drop? The shoe that Guinan specifically described as being a nightmare to work with? Talom is so agreeable. She disagrees, but, like, she's reasonable, I guess I should say, in all of the scenes with Picard in a way that I was not expecting. Like, what the hell happened between Guinan and her? Because I'm not seeing who she's described here.
Yeah. I mean, Guinan must have made claw hands at Talum also. Yeah, I mean, maybe we'll get backstory on that. Who knows?
Yeah. I'm going to be watching out for that, I think. Back at the chateau, the Nana Borg's voice is ringing across the countryside where it's permanently night at the chateau.
She's really Jeff Dunhaming her voice across the vineyard and into the chateau. And she wakes Jurati up, and Jurati's like, oh, that's racist. And she's like, yeah, but come quick. I need your help.
She looks up at the mantle and hits triangle to pick up the sawed-off shotgun, takes it into the La Serena, where it changes into a shotgun with a much longer barrel. What's up with the weapons continuity here, guys?
Oh, I didn't notice that. You think it's a different gun in the second shot?
I mean, either that or Allison Pill is extremely wee. And this barrel looks enormous in her tiny hands.
Okay, I think I know what made it look like that is there is a light source that casts the shadow of the barrel against the wall when it's mounted that makes it look like a double barrel shotgun.
Yeah.
Which would make it look shorter.
So what you're saying is I need to cast a light at my junk that that makes the shadow longer. Mm-hmm. And if I can just make the shadow longer, I can look more. It's about making light and shadow.
Mm-hmm.
It's about being a painter of light, Ben.
Yeah, and you know, when you hold the ruler up to the gun, you can measure all the way from the stock.
Yeah, don't measure from the trigger, measure from the stock, for sure.
So Jurati wakes up and chooses shotgun and boards the La Serena, where the queen has her tentacle wrapped around Leclerc's neck. And God, shout out to the prop department on this tentacle. It is so fucking gross looking.
It looks way less Borgy and way more disturbing animal.
Yeah. Like, oops, I accidentally clicked on a hentai video.
Yeah, it is rough stuff. And Leclerc is no match for it.
Yeah.
Not only is Leclerc no match for the tentacle, Jurati is no match for the shit-talking that the Nanoborgs is doing at her in this moment.
You're alone, Agnes, in every timeline. Every permutation, in every reality of this universe, you are utterly alone.
God, this sucks so bad. Like, you are not just a loser, you are dimensionally a loser. Ouch.
like, I believe that Jurati believes this in the moment, but I also think that if she took one step back, she would be like, the Borg Queen has not encountered me in every dimension. Like, she can't possibly know this.
That's sort of where I was at, too. Like, I kind of buy the whole idea of quantum mechanics and infinite versions and infinite realities. Like, I might push back on this if I'm a science person like Jurati.
Yeah.
I know I'm cool in at least one or two of those universes.
She pushes back very forcefully by pulling the trigger on the shotgun.
She pushes and pulls, huh?
Yeah. We cut to Dr. Soong's lab where he is analyzing the sample that Q gave him.
He pulls the scanner from below the frame, just clearly out of his butt.
Oh my God, it works.
Oh boy, does it work in a lot of ways.
Woo! Works real good. So, pretty quickly, we are out on the lawn of his Malibu beach house with his daughter, Corey, and she's got a much more humane-looking needle this time. I mean, it's like, it's still thick, but it's not like that thick.
Also, the light source is different. You're working with a natural light. It's not casting such a hard shadow. It doesn't look as big as it might have if you put that needle up on a mantle.
Right, yeah, which is like, you know, there's something kind of exciting about using a needle out in public, but it may reveal some things.
You want to measure from the plunger with a needle like this.
They have these drones hovering over them that are casting a shadow to protect her from the sun because she's like violently allergic to sunlight.
And air, too. It kind of boxes her in.
Yeah. And so she injects herself and then he causes the drone field. I don't know if we're going to have this kind of drone technology in 2 years, I have to say.
I mean, you go to Burning Man and you see the drones flying all synchronized and stuff.
But that's because you're smoking toad while you're there. And it's like, then you come down and you realize
they aren't actually flying that way.
Yeah. And it works. She's able to withstand the sunlight. She's able to withstand the air. It's a big relief.
Yeah. Dr. Soon's a proud papa.
Yeah. I also felt like there is some energy in Spiner's performance all through this that he is like a little bit disappointed that it works also because it means
it's not his idea.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I thought that that was a really nice element to the way he plays this.
Yeah, I like that too. There is some nice dimensionality that Brent Spiner brings to this moment and the whole episode.
Yeah.
He is so tightly wound though as a character.
Yeah.
He really does have that kind of coiled snake aspect to him that feels very dangerous.
Protective dad maybe wouldn't let his daughter jump in the pool first thing if she's never swam before, though, right?
Yeah.
I almost got the hang of it.
I wonder, given what happens to Corey on land, if they had entertained the idea of her having this moment in the water.
I wonder,
because there's
too,
something
yeah.
that multiplies the terror when someone is going through a medical circumstance like this in the water.
Yeah.
And there's something visually more intense about it too when you see, like, it's the Jaws thing. You see blood in the water and it's awful.
I think that probably what informed this is they knew that we were going to be watching this episode and we also host the Santa Monica Mountains podcast. So we would
right.
have a unique opportunity to compare a water rescue in this show to Baywatch. And,
right.
you know, they did it the best, you know. It's hard to, you can't compete.
What this scene does is stop Dr. Soong from taking off his entire ensemble from the Weekend at Bernie's collection in order to hop in the pool. He doesn't have to do that.
Yeah. But she gets back out on the pool deck and the serum wears off and the reaction that her body has to sun exposure when the serum isn't working is really scary to look at.
He's like, you put it in your butt, right? And she's like, what? Why would I? You were supposed to keister it. Dad, that's gross. You don't have to aim a butt bullet, Ben.
Mm.
Aim is always true. With the butt bullet.
So the first away team returns to La Serena to find Jurati dripping with blood, the Borg's queen with a chunk blown out of her neck, and Officer Leclerc lying on the bio bed in Six Bay. And Jurati has like patched him up, but he's KO'd.
His spleen's in a box over there.
And she's also wiped his short-term memory, so.
He got the Men in Black treatment.
Yeah, but she's pretty beat up over it. And this is when Talum and Picard return to the ship. And I thought this was such a funny moment. I got a genuine LOL when she's like, so what's up with this crew? Can you trust them? And he's like, they're the best. They never do anything crazy.
Oh, I'm sure he's not dead.
The reason I'm not in this writer's room is that I would have proposed cutting into Leclerc's car when he wakes up like, what was in that cigarette? Whoa!
Loic has played another prank on me, that son of a bitch. Back at the station.
Those French cigarettes really kick, huh?
Always putting DMT into my Galois.
Back in the Soong estate, Corey's back on the couch resting comfortably. I guess Dr. Soong was able to save her from a condition that looked completely fatal.
Yeah. Did not look good.
Yeah.
Q is there making the case for, like, first one's free, but I can give you one that, like, actually will last if you do something for me.
Right. All you have to do is take Rene Picard off the board. That's it.
Interesting that Q needs help.
Back at the chateau, Raffi and Picard share a moment about how strange it is that Talum looks so much like Laris.
Not now. But she looks exactly like...
I'm aware.
Well, doesn't that make you feel a little kind of creepy?
Yes.
Good talk.
Which should be the only thing anyone talks about this entire episode. You know, it's actually not that big of a deal. I'm already over it.
I really enjoy living in a world where lots of different women look like that.
You know, my hit rate actually goes up. You know, most women in this timeline are like a 7 average. Oh no, 7's not going to work for this joke because of her name. You know, most women in this timeline are between a 6 and an 8, but Laris. Laris is a 10 for me.
And you know me, I love to take tens forward.
I measure from deck 8.
So they have a McLaughlin group.
Issue 1.
Talum shows them the footage of Q, the therapist, and talk about how Q has been kind of giving Rene Picard nudges toward quitting the mission. And they have like mere hours left. They need to get Rene like back into a headspace where she can go on this mission. She's destined to find this microorganism that she thinks is sentient on Io and bring it back. And it's like a big deal historically. So they need to get some FaceTime with her. And the last thing she does before quarantine is this gala. And so we get the non-reverse heist film sequence where we discuss how we're going to infiltrate the gala. And it is like a Mission Impossible level deal with the security. It's really intense.
I like how it's not just the RFID invitations. It's the facial recognition once you're in there.
Yeah.
It's two-factor party authentication.
Sure is. And Picard is really keen on sending Jurati in to do the mission. I think maybe partly this is because she has the skills, but partly because she like needs a win. Like he's like doing a leadership thing where he's like, we left her behind last time. It wasn't fair. Also, it doesn't seem like she's that trustworthy because she blew off the head of the Borg Queen. And how do we get home now?
This is episode 5. we're not that far removed from all of Picard's decisions being bad this season, right? Why are we listening to him if we're the McLaughlin group here?
Some questions being proposed by Rios about maybe we should send Seven or Raffi in first. Yeah. But
these are trained partiers.
Yeah. Jurati is going to go in and basically get caught. She's going to take like fake ID to get past the first stage, but she's going to intentionally fail the second stage so that she can get into the security area where she'll find a way to access the computers. And we're like intercutting with the actual party while they're discussing this plan.
If what you need as part of your plan is someone to act strange enough to be pinched, like Jurati is actually a great choice because this was all part of the plan the whole time. She gets pinched and taken into the security office just like they planned.
Yeah.
Hello.
Do you think that they replicated all their evening wear at this point? Because they had to like find stuff that didn't look too fascist to go out in public in like episode when they first arrive in this time.
That's a great convention question. Like, they didn't have power on the ship to replicate, clearly.
But now they do, maybe? Anyways.
It's not fun to ask those questions.
No. She arrives in a hell of a dress.
Yeah.
But does get pinched and gets sent into the back. There was a line I wanted to interrogate with you. She's been like double handcuffed to this bench in the security area. Like one hand on each armrest is handcuffed. And there's two security guards and they're talking about how she's like snuck into the party and that's weird.
Why is she cuffed?
She's a trespasser. Ramsey said to get her prints.
She's probably from Newport Beach. We're gonna get sued.
What does that mean?
I haven't lived in L.A. long enough to get the reference. I don't know.
I mean, Newport Beach, that's in Orange County, but like why? I don't know. I didn't get what that meant at all.
Yeah.
I wonder either. if the significance of it is yet to be revealed or if it's like a joke for locals only that I just don't get.
Oh, yeah. Maybe you have to be from there.
I don't know. Anyways, Jurati got assimilated.
Resistance is futile.
As a result, she's seeing the Nanoborgs when she's not there.
Yeah. The Nanoborg makes the case that she's been planning it this way all along and that the way that Jurati is infiltrating this party nicely mirrors the way in which Nanoborg has been orchestrating the entire situation up until now.
Yeah.
Pretty wild.
That's the end of the episode, Ben. Did you like it?
I did like it. This episode really goes on a journey. Like, I did not see Mission Impossible Gala at the end of this episode when this episode started. That was a huge surprise to me. And I really thought it was a lot of fun. I thought that the vulnerability and the, like, intellectual fragility of the Adam Soong character was really interesting. Like, somebody that genuinely believes in eugenics and...
Eugenics for the right reasons.
Well, yeah, but that's it, right? It's like he's a total ends justify the means guy and doesn't see the problem with those ends being bad. So that is like a guy that would be uniquely vulnerable to the kind of appeals that Q is making. I thought Brent Spiner did a great job. I was really happy to see Issa Briones back in the show and very curious to see, like, because Adam Soong seems to be kind of a founding father figure in the future that they just came from. So that eugenics outlook seems to have become sort of a foundational idea in human politics going forward. Noonien Soong is an eccentric weirdo in TNG, but like there is kind of a dark side to the kind of research he's doing. And if you can get with the idea that his great, 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 great grandfather was also up to like similar kinds of research, but using far more limited technology, it's interesting to think about like that technology gone wrong.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting that when you start messing around with that backstory, I think you might unintentionally change how a person might feel about Data. Because this is a family business, right?
Right.
Generation after generation after generation has led to a character that we really like. But if the characters involved were evil, as it seems like the road that this Sung is walking, kind of gives you a weirder feeling about the costs involved with making a Data, you know? I'm with you, Ben. I like the episode, and I like it more because, like, the last episode moved the pieces around, and this episode pays that off, right? Like, this is getting our Warhammer characters in proximity to people to interact with, and those interactions are happening, and there are consequences now. I mean, in the last episode, everyone was separated, and now they're together, and that's where the action happens. So, yeah, I liked it a lot, and I was not familiar with Penelope Mitchell's work before this episode. I know she's a working actor and she's in a bunch of sci-fi and related programs. You know, we've talked episode after episode about, like, wow, casting young Guinan, got to get that right. And they did. And you listen to Penelope Mitchell talk and you look at her in a scene and, like, she is plausibly Picard.
Yeah.
In a way that works so far. So I'm interested in seeing what happens with her character next, but I'm enjoying the performance so far.
Well, do you want to see if you enjoy any of the Priority One messages in our Priority One inbox, Adam?
It just has to do with whether or not I can perform them ably.
Priority One message from Starfleet coming in on secured channel.
The first Priority One message is from Pedro. It is to Paolo, Dave, Jess, and Chris. The message goes like this. Fellow Picardologists, you know, you could turn that into Picardiologist, couldn't you? Given his heart condition.
Well, he doesn't have it anymore.
Right, yeah. I'm so grateful for the camaraderie we've developed through our common love of Trek. Paul, you're the best brother a brother could ask for. Dave, you have a singular wit, and I couldn't ask for a better ring bearer. Chris, I love your takes on pretty much everything. And Jess, well, you're just the most badass person I know.
Wow.
Really spreading the love is Pedro.
I love
it. P1. That's a crew right there.
Yeah.
Get yourself a crew like Pedro's crew.
Yeah. Our next one here is from Jack from Melbourne, Australia, and it is to Ben and Adam, the greatest podcast host and the entire Uxbridge Shimoda team. Goes like this. Your podcasts have helped me through 4+ years of commutes, workouts, dog walks, and household chores, and made a crucial contribution to positive mental health in challenging times. I have a Kern-like inability to remember how I coped without them. My second annual P1 is simply a huge and sincere thanks for being the greatest discovery my ears have ever made. Aw!
Wow, Jack. Thanks, Jack.
So kind of you to say.
There is one way you could make it up to us. figure out how we could do a show in Australia.
Yeah, that would be
great. Wouldn't that be great?
That's not really Jack's job. Like, we have an agent for that. Yeah, if there's like a podcast festival or something like that in Australia, definitely recommend us to them. If they've got like an email, that would be cool.
Jack is so nice about their message. I just want to make it up.
Yeah.
With a live show.
I would love to get out to Melbourne and do a live show. That would be the funnest.
Yeah. I bet their rooftop hot tubs are heated a little better than the ones in Minneapolis.
I'm sure the hot tub is not that different. It's just the air that you have to walk through to find the server that's different.
The bubbles bubble the opposite direction there, Ben.
Oh, right. Yeah, they go down. Wow. Well, if you'd like to get a Priority One message on the show, we would sure appreciate it. It's $100 for a personal message and $200 for a commercial message, and you can do that at MaximumFun.org/Jumbotron.
Hey, Ben.
What's that, Adam?
Did you discover yourself an Edward Larkin?
Edward Larkin! Adam, my Edward Larkin is deep, deep off-screen.
Whoa.
It is a headcanon Larkin. I guess it was the eugenic stuff that Adam Soong was talking that put me in this headspace, but I was thinking about Nguyen Sung, who is the creator of Data. Mm-hmm. And we know that Khan Nguyen Sung was like one of the most brutal autocrats in Earth history in future time. So that would be like if your last name was Hurtler and you named your son Adolf. Like, nobody makes the connection if his name is like Jerry. But the second you name him Adolf, it's like, ugh, that sounds just like Adolf Hitler. They named their son Nguyen Sung.
What did they think was going to happen? Besides, like, a very difficult path through school.
So fucking lucky that he didn't turn out the way Adam Sung did. Is all I got to say.
Yeah. God, you're right about that.
Did you have an Edward Larkin, Adam?
I think it's going to be the Borg Queen until it isn't.
Wow.
The Nana Borg pulling strings and throwing tentacles all over the place. She's barely in this episode, and she really affects some destruction as far as like value per minute. She's really off the charts at this point, so that's why I'm just gonna make her my Larkin until someone knocks her off the podium.
Wow.
Which would be pretty easy to do because she's pretty top heavy. But.
So you've kind of given up on picking out Larkins for the rest of the season, more or less.
Not at all. I believe in the other character's ability to do that.
Oh, okay. All right.
And I'm here for it. I want that to happen. But for now, Nana Borgs.
Okay. All right. I'm into it.
Are you into the sixth episode of Star Trek Picard?
I am, Adam. And folks will hear about that in the credits for this episode. But for now, I think it's our time to sign off.
Yeah, it's time to hop on a plane.
Yeah.
Head to Toronto.
No, I think we're back from Toronto when this comes out, right?
Oh, shit. Well, no, I mean, like, that's behind the pod. Like, we can be past people.
Right.
Heading to Toronto to do a great show.
Right, but if you're listening to this, don't go to the Toronto live show because it already happened.
Right, if you're listening to this show on the day it comes out, this is our Northwest swing. So it's Portland and Seattle this week.
Cannot wait. That is going to be super fun.
It's going to be fun shows. Bring your swimsuit, Ben.
Oh.
That's what I'm saying.
Good thinking. All right, well, now listen to these credits and find out a little something about the next episode.
The Greatest Discovery is an Uxbridge Shimoda podcast on the Maximum Fun Network. It's hosted by Ben Harrison and Adam Pranica, and it's produced by Wendy Pretty. This episode was guest edited by Ryan Wheaton. Next week's episode of Picard is titled Two of One and is described thusly by Paramount. With the help of Talon, Picard and the crew infiltrate a gala on the eve of a joint space mission to protect one of the astronauts they believe to be integral to the restoration of the timeline, Rene Picard. Meanwhile, Corey makes a startling discovery about her father's work. The original music for the show, including the music you're hearing right now, is by Adam Ragusea. He's currently got a fun and informative cooking channel on YouTube, which you can find by simply searching Adam Ragusea. Big thanks go out to the card daddy Bill Tilly for managing the Greatest Trek social media accounts on Instagram and Twitter. Give us a follow on those and use the hashtag GreatestDiscovery to chat about the show with other FODs. If you enjoy this podcast and would like to support it with money, you can purchase a P1 for an upcoming episode at MaximumFun.org/Jumbotron. You can also support the show for free by recommending it to a friend or leaving a nice review on platforms that let you do that. Thanks for listening. We'll be back next week with more of The Greatest Discovery.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Audience supported.